Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears coming at you here on a Thursday morning, June 11th, 2026, 18 minutes past the hour. Glad to have you with us, and as many of you know, this week we are celebrating our 12th anniversary on the air. Over 9,000 hours in this particular program. We have had a great time this week, and I do want to remind everybody, we have a big special coming up tonight, live special. You won't want to miss a lot of surprises tonight, 7 to 9 p.m. on this station, a live 12th anniversary WGH Talk special. Don't miss that for love nor money. We've had some tremendous guests this week on the morning program. This morning is no exception. I cannot wait to get to our first guest. He's one of my favorite people. And next hour, we've got a guest who I know you are going to like. But before we do that, really quickly, I want to do this because it is 12th anniversary week, and we're kind of looking back on some of our favorite moments from the last 12 years. And there's one I wanted to play this morning that goes back to October 17th, 2016. October 17th, 2016, 10 years ago. Can you believe that? Here's a little conversation we had with the former, now late, Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, on this program. Take it away, Madeleine.
When Hillary Clinton's name is mentioned anywhere, you're one of the only people I can ask this of, the two buzzwords that come up, Benghazi emails, immediately. Two-part question, do you feel she did anything wrong in either one of those positions, and why is Hillary the right person for Ohio and the country?
Well, I think she has said herself that she made a mistake on the emails. She has taken responsibility for that. I think on Benghazi, I don't think she did anything wrong. By the way, if you ask people where Benghazi is, when they just say Benghazi, they say somewhere in the Middle East, meaning that they have not a clue, just because the word Benghazi. That Benghazi was a huge tragedy, many people were involved in making assessments of it, and Chris Evans is somebody that worked for me, and his death and that of the others is a huge tragedy, but it is not anything that Hillary did. And I think that what is important is to understand that in Hillary we have a person who has more experience in national security policy than anybody that has ever run for president. I trust her. I trust her with the security of our people, and I trust her temperament and her ability to understand what a difficult world we live in. And I don't trust Donald Trump, who explodes, who has, gets up at 3 a.m. to do nasty tweets, who disregards individuals. He is not a representative for America. And this is an absolutely crucial election.
Secretary Albright, one quick parting question here. During this campaign, in the beginning, a lot of attention was thrust upon you when you were introducing Clinton at a campaign event in New Hampshire. You said there's a special place in hell for women who don't help each other. It's a unique election, could be the first woman president. You've certainly made headroads there, being the first woman Secretary of State. Do you regret that at all now, saying that?
No, but I tell you, I've said that statement now forever, and what people didn't hear, because they had started to applaud already, was I looked at Hillary and I said, therefore you are going to the other place because of everything that you have done for women. And I think the very important part about Hillary is that she has, in fact, been an advocate for women's issues for her whole life. She understands that we need equal pay for equal work, that we need to have control over our own bodies, that when women are economically and politically empowered, societies function better. And when she is elected president, it will be the 100th anniversary of when American women got the vote. We need to get out there and use it, because Hillary Clinton is the best prepared person ever to become President of the United States, and it's just a bonus that she's a woman. And I'm honored to be able to speak on her behalf.
And I'm
the late former Secretary of State, first female Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, on this program, October 17th, 2016. And now our guest, he is one of my favorite people. As I have said, he has been a pal to me over the last several years. Coming on anytime there's an election, anytime something needs sorting out in the world, anytime there's a major news event, I can call him on short notice. He always gives great opinions as well as a great analysis of what is going on. And one thing I have learned in doing this particular program for 12 years and over 9,000 hours, if you don't have good guests, you can't have a good show. This show is always about the guest, and the guest that's going to kick us off today for the first hour is legendary ABC News correspondent Sam Donaldson. Sam, how are you?
Well, I'm great, and I agree with Madeleine Albright. It was one of my favorites after she left the office, and I was no longer a reporter. On occasion, we were able to get together and share a little taste of something or other. But I'm going to turn the tables on you. I know a lot about you, but not everything I should.
All right.
12 years. How did you get into the business of interviewing people in the radio?
Well, I'll tell you that hopefully it's an interesting story, Sam. I've been doing this show for 12 years, but I've been in broadcast for quite a bit longer. What actually happened, I went to college to be a teacher. I was teaching, and I wasn't really enjoying it. A lot of people have that calling. I didn't have that calling. One day I was in the teacher's lounge, and the local newspaper was in there. They were advertising for a job for a reporter, and I thought that sounded interesting because I had an English degree. But you had to have experience, or you had to have a journalism degree. I didn't have either. So I called the college up. I said, what would it take to get a journalism degree with the credits I already have? They said, well, why don't you see if that's something you really want to do? Do a 10-week unpaid internship in journalism. See how it goes. I called the local radio station and the local paper because I knew it was going to be unpaid, and I didn't want to drive a long distance every day for an unpaid internship. The radio station called back first. I went there. The first day, I didn't do anything but filing. The second day, the person who did county commissioners did not show up. I'd never been to a county commissioner meeting in my life. They sent me down there. I covered it. I came back, wrote the story up. They said they liked it. They said do that for the next 10 weeks. In that 10 weeks, I guess I got a little pushy. I started interviewing people. I started calling people up. To this day, people say, how do you get the quality of guests you get? I don't know. I guess I'm just pushy and persistent. I did that in those 10 weeks, and at the end of the 10 weeks, when the program director came in to sign off on the internship, and I was ready to go to journalism school, he said, when can you start? And that's how it started.
Well, I like the business about the accident. The guy didn't show up. Hey, you were there. You said, well, look, let me try it. And it worked out. Now, I've got one other thing about it, though. What is this thing about President Harding's dog collar?
Well, that is an interesting story. In 2012, I believe it was 2012, President Harding, for some reason, when there were tours of the Harding home, which is here in Marion, one of the things that stuck out to kids was Laddie Boy, President Harding's dog collar. And kids love to see that. Well, there was a burglary in 2012, and it was in the middle of the night. Somebody stole the dog collar. That's all they stole, from the second-story window. And I always thought that was a weird story. There were never any leads. There was never anything else to do with that particular story, and it just kind of died. Nobody knew what happened to the dog collar. One day, and they may be listening today, I was in the grocery store, and a person came up to me, and they said, do you think a reward would help get that dog collar back? And I said, I don't know, maybe. And they said, I'll tell you what, I will give you $5,000 as a reward, But here's the deal. You can never tell anybody who I am, and you have to give the money to the person who returns the dog collar. And what ended up funny in that, I had the prosecutor in town who said he would not prosecute the person who returned it, even if it was the person who stole it, and the police chief who said they would not arrest the person. So to this day, somebody could collect $5,000 if they brought that dog collar back, even though they haven't.
What a deal to make $5,000. Okay, I've got one final question or two, and then it's turned over to you. And here is the question. Who said, Iran is playing us for suckers? Hey, I agree with the statement. And Iran will play the price for not making a deal. I'm not sure. Maybe so. So it's over to you, Scott.
You know, I believe, if I'm not mistaken here, that is our current president, Donald Trump.
Yes, if it was only worth $5,000, but he doesn't deal in small amounts. He wants $1.8 billion. Go ahead.
So yes, I believe that. And isn't that an interesting point? Well, what do you make of where we are with Iran at this point?
That's very difficult to say. I'm talking to you, and at this moment, President Trump may have just changed his mind again and said we're going to bomb him back to the ages. Or he can say, yes, we're just about to make a deal. I expect it to be signed any day now. He is all over the lot because they've got him. He can't get loose. And we're in with him. So I'm not saying wonderful. I'm glad if he gets his comeuppance or anything. I want the country to come out of this as good as it can. And so if he can make a deal that is satisfactory to him and the country, obviously, because we're in this now, then I'm all for it. But I'm not sure what he's doing. He doesn't know what he's doing. On the weekend when he and Bibi Netanyahu, who egged him on, decided it would be almost child's play to walk into Iran, drop a few bombs, tell him, I'm the boss, and I'll do everything I want, and suddenly find that he's caught.
You know, Sam, I've been doing a little more reading on the whole Iran situation prior to Trump getting involved, and correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, but isn't it true this is why, even though Iran has been a thorn and a major thorn in our side at different times, under President Jimmy Carter with the hostage crisis, under President Reagan with the Iran-Contra situation, President Obama, the Iran deal, one of the reasons it was never turned into a military strike on Iran is because it was always thought this isn't going to be easy. 20% of the world's oil comes through the Strait of Hormuz. It would hurt the global economy. That's what they were going to go for because they know their military can't stand up to our military. But we also don't want to put troops on the ground in Iran because they really don't like us and they don't. They want to fight, I mean, and this is their fight, by blocking the Strait of Hormuz. Has that always been the common wisdom?
Well, in recent times, because you have to go back to the point where Iran was not run by Ayatollahs. Iran was sort of a democratic state in a sense. We had protected the oil companies from having its oil nationalized in 1954. Things were going all right. And then Ayatollah Khomeini came from exile in Paris and put in place a non-secular government, a government ruled because of the religion, which is very dangerous in the Middle East to Israel and to other states also. And from that point on, we've had a problem. I want to just point out something that you said that I think is very important if you look at the history. In the Obama administration, John Kerry, the Secretary of State, led a group which for well over a year had the negotiation with Iran and the mullahs on the atomic energy issue. No one wanted, outside of Iran, I suppose, the atomic bomb, because Iran made it clear if it had weapons like that, it would move to destroy the state of Israel. And I think today, although Mr. Netanyahu is making it more and more difficult, as the polls show here in America, to just support them lock, stock, and barrel, we are behind Israel. So we are locked in a problem here where the Strait of Hormuz was open, 20% of the oil was going through a terribly. Of course, there's only 20%. A significant amount of oil the world gets, as you see when it gets shut down, and you were to buy a gallon of gasoline. Very significant. We didn't have a problem that was ongoing until President Trump walked into the office, and one of his first acts was to abrogate the treaty with Iran, which was about to run out after 10 years. That was the deal. Iran had to keep its hands off a continuation of working on an atomic bomb and atomic material for 10 years. And they had. Well, how do I know? I can't say for sure. But the Atomic Energy Commission had inspectors in there and were watching it very closely. And people thought they were complying. And maybe even they thought they were complying with the idea that after the 10 years, they'd make a new one and see what they could get. Well, what they got was an abrogation of the old one before any new one was in place. Trump simply saying, I'll do it my way, without figuring out what his way would be. He was in the mood, as he always has been, to do, I will do what I want to do, and anyone who brooks interference with it is wrong. Not only wrong, but an enemy of the people, enemy of the democracy in the United States. Well, I've gone on too long with this. It is a fascinating history, and here we are. That history could take a very ugly turn.
You know, Sam, there are two things, and I think maybe one more important than the other, that people have said to me. Is it true that we can talk about this posturing and we can talk about negotiations, but really the only way at this point the United States could absolutely end this war would be to put troops on the ground? And the second thing I keep hearing from other people who seem to be a little bit in the know is that if Iran did not have nuclear capability before, you can darn sure bet they're trying to get it now because of the threats and the attacks that we have laid upon them.
Well, I think that's true. I think it's true in the sense when I say we're at a dangerous point here. We're almost always in the world someplace, but it's now in Iran, in a place that for so many reasons counts and for so many reasons must be solved peacefully. Now, troops on the ground, if you ask the average American today, particularly with a long history of a place called Vietnam, where we had the most power in the world, we could have blown up the world. No one could challenge us. We could defeat Vietnam, and for some good reasons. We didn't go all out. We didn't one day decide we would blow them out of history, as Mr. Trump did a few weeks ago, when he was really in a terrible mood. I don't have a real solution for this, except to say we could withdraw. Now, he never will. Yes, he can get out. I said he's caught. He can withdraw and say, you know, I think I've made a strategic error here. Let's go back to the ante. But he can't go back to the way it was. We had control, meaning the international community. Iran did not have control over the Straits of Hormuz. Now it controls. And unless we can dispose it, and if you say, let's ask the Americans, send those boys and girls over there to fight on the ground, I bet you don't get them. Favorable response. And if the country is behind a war, as we saw happen in Vietnam, we're not going to survive it.
Sam, the biggest question I have had since the end of February, when this all broke loose, and I remember the day it happened, I'm sure as a lot of people do, it's certainly not ancient history, when we opened up this attack on Iran and killed the Ayatollah, why did we believe that first week that this was going to be easy? Why did we believe that Iran was just a country sitting there waiting for regime change, had no army that could do anything, had no power in the world, Israel was dominating them, and they were just a big nothing? Why did we believe that?
The word is arrogance. Again, we were led by someone who believed he could do anything. The United States could do anything he wanted it to do. And other nations would bow to him. And they haven't. And they won't. And the more it drags on, that's why I say, I can't give a great solution. I do it. The more it drags on, the worse it gets, not the better. Now, yes, they're playing us for suckers, and I'm glad he recognizes that. They make some promises, put them on the table. It looks like a plan that maybe work if we can just do this or do that. And it goes on day after day, day after day. Iran can have all the time in the world that it wants and to do the things that it wants with that. We don't have all the time in the world unless we take some kind of measure that just cuts it off. And if we tried to do that now, if we tried to use our bombs, which were basically ineffective when we set the big B-2s over and all of that, and President Trump said, what, a year and a half ago, we got them all. Hey, no, no, Mr. President, you never get them all. Not this way. He could withdraw, but it's not in him. I think he would want to die first and admit he ever made a mistake, anytime, any place, anywhere.
Sam, I want to turn to a different subject here, and this is one I wanted to have you on regardless of the anniversary about, because you were a longtime White House correspondent, President Reagan, and for President Clinton, and a lot of people saw exchanges that you had with Reagan and exchanges that you had with Clinton, certainly bipartisan exchanges, you could say, and Caitlin Collins over at CNN certainly had an interesting time with President Trump about a week ago today. Now, I'm just going to play this 53-second clip because I think, what do they say, showing works better than telling? Hearing probably works better than telling. Here's what happened at the White House with Caitlin Collins of CNN about a week ago during a White House press conference.
We are going over the coming weeks and months, you're not even going to believe. Some of you will believe it, like CNN will believe it because they knew what was going on. They're crooked as hell. CNN's a very corrupt organization, but with a corrupt reporter standing right there, never smiles. You never see a young, beautiful woman, never smiles. I never see a smile off her face. I see her standing there with hatred in her eyes, like she has hatred because we have borders, because we have a strong military, because we cut our taxes, because we do things that everybody wanted, and then we win our election in a massive landslide. You should be ashamed of yourself. You used to be a conservative. She was a conservative from Alabama, can you believe it? But CNN, in particular, CNN does such false reporting. But now they have new ownership, so maybe it'll straighten it out. I doubt it. But it's hard to straighten garbage out.
Sam, as a longtime White House correspondent, what do you make of that?
Well, since I've known Donald J. Trump for 40 years, 35 probably, I was not amazed by this time in his second presidency. He was acting that way, calling women piggy, saying the most vicious things about the organizations or what have you, and getting away with it. And what do I mean getting away with it? In the day I was there, there was civility on both sides. The president may not have liked the question I asked or was persisted in, but never tried to talk to me or anyone else that way. It wasn't just me. They may have gone in their office and said, damn it, Donaldson. But they didn't say it to me, and they didn't say it publicly. And I never gave a public view other than we're doing now about my assessment of a politician I covered or a president. It was such a different day. It was easy to get along. And by easy to get along, it meant we had a comity. We had two different jobs, one of supreme importance, the other of importance to our news organization and our viewers or our readers. But it was all still working when I was there, even toward the end. But not when Trump came. That was the difference. And the thing I've always, in recent days, tried to figure out, what happened to half the country? Where did it come from? They're good American citizens. They have every right to be here than I do. But why do they fall for this guy? Why, in issue after issue, whether it comes to women, whether it comes to the use of money, whether it comes for his personal engagement, if Harry Truman left the office without a place to go. He never owned a house. And he had no pension from the federal government. And this man is enriching himself and his family daily with deals made from the Oval Office. And why do so many Americans say, oh, that's okay, that's just him, and I like the way he treats the foreigners or the black people or the Jews or whatever it is that they see in him? Because he's very transparent. He doesn't try to hide it. you know where he stands, even though on any given day he may not know where he stands, but he'll tell you what he thinks.
You know, Sam, what this made me think of was when you were at the White House covering Washington in those days as a correspondent, not the president, but the late Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill. I think Tip even wrote about this in his book, that he had had an episode with you at one point. Do you remember this episode, Sam?
Which episode is that? A health episode or what?
No, what happened was apparently you were questioning Tip about something, Tip O'Neill, that he did not want to be questioned about.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and he shot something back at you, and I don't think you ended up using it. I think it was something about Kiss's Irish rear end or something like that.
He may have. I should remember that. That would be a famous Tip O'Neill. I could put it in my biography. I like Tip. I liked him very much because he's just one thing, Irishman, you know. Second, he was effective. He was effective for almost all of his career, except when Ronald Reagan came and beat him on the tax issue, the very first big issue that Reagan rolled the Democratic Congress on. And we started seeing that this guy from a movie set can roll the best politicians in the country. We better pay attention to him. Now, I like so many of those people on both sides of the aisle. I practiced democracy when it came to Republicans and Democrats. Now, when it came to individuals who, again, have prejudices that I think is inimical to them and the country, I don't really like them. But there weren't that many of them I had to deal with. Mm. Now, let me just ask you a question while we're on this subject of politics. Had you, before just a few months ago, or maybe even a few weeks ago, heard of a man named Graham Plattner?
No, but boy, you hear about him now.
You bet. He's running against Susan Collins in Maine. The long time, every Democrat's favorite Republican, if we have to have one. And by the way, I looked it up the other day. Susan Collins, Senator Collins' record is in Trump's first term, she supported him 90% of the time on the legislative floor. And this year, she is supporting him 94.5% of the time. So to say she's everyone's favorite Republican, if they have to have one in Maine, Susan's got the lid pulled over her eyes a little bit. Anyways, she's going to be a very tough fight now. Because why? Because Graham Plattner has a background in politics of, like Tip O'Neill, solving problems, about trying to look at issues that his public, his voters, really support. No. He is, one Wall Street Journal reporter did a column, I think it was yesterday, if there is any part of his character which is not malignant, we have yet to hear about it. His filthy messages, sexual messages to many women, rough treatment of women, the Nazi death camp tattoo on his chest. So I think this guy's very smart. He says, what appeals to voters isn't the message despite the ugliness, but the message itself. And that's scary. Mm. Maine is not a state well known for the kind of fiery politics that will burn you to the ground. Maine is kind of a nice average American state. But the Democrats want to win so badly, they will put aside these disqualifications that the people like me are our disqualification from office. Let me just tell you one last thing on this. In 1952, two men ran for the presidency of the United States. One was Dwight Eisenhower, the former chief of our forces in Europe, and a man who had a little difficulty grappling with the English language now and then. The other was Adlai Stevenson, a bookish man, for governor of Illinois, who would sit down and bore you to death. But during that campaign, there was not a single name called, not a single ad issue that hit below the belt, and it won. The campaign won, as far as I was concerned. Today, we're in the midst of a divide in this country where every issue is combative. Every issue must be decided on the playing fields in the worst possible way. We've got to come out of this. So I don't know whether this man Platt is going to win. Susan Collins may win a fourth term. But look at Texas and Ken Paxton. Anyway.
Well, Sam, let me come in on this Plattner, because this really is interesting. Because the polls in Maine are apparently showing right now that Plattner has 51% and Susan Collins has 49%, and the Democrats do see this as a way to take back the Senate, and they do feel that these are extraordinary times with the president we have. Not only is he the candidate being left up to the voters in Maine, but you've got Senator Bernie Sanders saying, vote for him. You've got the head of the Senate, Democrat, or the minority leader in the Senate, Democrat Chuck Schumer, endorsing him last week after he met with him. I had former Governor Strickland on the program yesterday, and I said, if you lived in Maine, would you vote for him? Without hesitation, yes. And some Democrats are even going back to Lindbergh and saying, well, Lindbergh was a Nazi sympathizer, so, you know, people we loved in the past and revered, well, you know, they weren't perfect people. Is that the way to pick a politician?
Well, you talk about perfect people. There is no one, yourself included, and certainly me. And you hear the end justifies the means. I suppose in some extreme situations, you could make that case about a specific matter or issue. But the end almost always does not justify the means. And yet, if the Democrats want to take back the Senate, they need Maine. Mm. They need Texas, if they could possibly get it. And the polls are even down there at the moment. For the man that, as a non-working reporter for years, I've never heard of, until he suddenly appears on the scene, is in the legislature of Texas. His name is Tallarico. Tallarico, I hope I'm mispronouncing it correctly.
I think Tallarico. Tallarico.
Thank you. I told you I didn't know everything. but the whole firmament has changed from the standpoint of American politics, how we got into this. We kind of slid into it. And when we slid, the young people who came along didn't have anyone to teach them what is in the Constitution of the United States. They know AI. They know how to do things with decibels, with electrons that I never heard of. They're going to make a lot of money. That's okay, as long as it's done legally, in my idea, or my opinion. You try to be good citizens. But they don't know the foundation of our country. We're still about to celebrate the 250th anniversary next Sunday at the White House with a boxing match. Well, I looked it up, and unfortunately, in my view, this is only the second time it's happened. It hasn't happened under Trump. 1926, it happened again with a boxing match. There are so many ways to celebrate this country, and a great arch dedicated, of course, to who? Donald J. Trump. There's so many ways to look at the dedication of this country that to say the boxing match should be the symbol. It's okay with me if it's okay with you.
Well, we'll see how that all plays out. You know, a moment of recent interest to people, Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche stated that Donald Trump absolutely would have faced prison time if he had not won the 2024 presidential election. Blanche, who previously led Trump's defense team in his New York criminal trial, made the comments in an interview on Sean Hannity's podcast. When asked by Hannity if it was the White House or the Big House, Blanche agreed, stating, "Oh, yes, absolutely." Blanche explained that given the pending federal cases and the New York conviction, imprisonment was a certainty had Trump not won. Regarding the 34 felony count conviction in New York, Blanche asserted that the judge would have absolutely sent Trump to prison. And this is his lawyer, an attorney general. Now, again, they're not saying they're guilty, but they're saying that Trump would have gone to prison had he not become president. What do you make of that?
Yeah. What they're saying is the system would have been rigged against Trump, and he wouldn't have a chance to honestly defend himself and see that the evidence demonstrated. And by the way, evidence. Did you see that interview on some part of an interview on Meet the Press this Sunday?
Oh, yeah.
Trump sitting down there with the moderator and complaining already that California's election, which was held the other day, and is always a slow vote in California, has been rigged. It's been rigged against the Republicans, actually. And she asked the obvious question, a simple and, I think, a very respectful question, what is the evidence you have of that? No evidence. When you hear Trump say, well, everyone knows that, he doesn't have any evidence at all. And he doesn't think he needs to put it in. He is making the case for next November that in California, it's all going to be rigged. And no matter who they say won finally at the ballot box, they will say it's wrong. We'll have an investigation. By the way, already the Justice Department is looking into that vote, because California always counts the vote late. It's going to be a tough fight this November. Anyone, and you may have heard me say this before, I hope I did to you, everyone who, even at this point, the way the polls show Trump with 35% and some of his people, but not all of them, losing, that's going to be a cinch for the Democrats to retake at least one house of the Congress. I don't think so. I think it'll be a dogfight, a back-alley knife fight with the worst types of weapons you could consider until we finally get some count. And remember, once we had a presidential wait till the 16th of December, 2020, you may see something worse than that.
Well, you know, Sam, this has been something, and I think, in a way, people don't want to bring it up because they don't want to think it could happen, and they don't want to jinx themselves in a way saying that it could happen. But we know that that's redistricting has gone on. We know that the way voting is done has kind of been messed around with. I kind of want to step lightly around that. Is there a possibility, I don't think we've had fixed elections, but is there a possibility that something like that could happen?
I guess it could. I guess what was the year, 18, after Grant, when we had an election decided by the House of Representatives on the basis of states rather than the basis of votes. So I guess it could happen again and we would survive. But these are such dangerous times with competitors on the world stage we never had before. Once we gained the supremacy in the world as the great giant that had the economy, that had the military power, that had the people, had the safety of two oceans. You remember that?
Mm.
And it could happen again. I can't predict the future. You look at the present and say, what's the likelihood? And then you keep your fingers crossed.
Do you think that if President Trump, going into that first week in November, believes polls, we know he watches a lot of television, and believes that he's going to lose the House and the Senate, that he will do nothing?
No, I thought he would do everything he promised. He's making some promises he's desperately trying to keep. And I will simply say what I believe to be he and his most avid supporters with the 2025 program laid out before them, because they're transparent. They want a return to what they believe was a white, Christian America run by men. Everything you see he does points in that direction.
Want to talk about the 250th anniversary of America again, because a recent poll came out that said 1 in 5 Democrats are proud to be an American and 2 in 3 Republicans are proud to be an American because of the way things are in the country right now. That could be food prices, that could be gas prices, that could be the current administration. What do you make of that particular poll?
Well, if that's true, it shows the good sense of most Americans. We live in the most prosperous country, the country that has the ability to support our people in a good way, in every detail. Now, we don't do it. Poor people don't get the break I get. Poor people and other people of maybe the wrong color don't get the break that I get. So we're not there yet, but where else would you like to live? Why do you think this great mass of people that came across our southern border, the president said was an army of infiltrators to get into our country, why did they want to get in? Because there's nothing here for them? There's no job opportunity here for them? There's no better life for them here for them? There's no freedom from in their own country? The powers that be suppress them from liberty? No, it's because the United States is the shining city on the hill. But we're losing that luster by the hands and feet. And how long it'll be before we get it back? Harry Truman came up with NATO, which kept the peace from the Soviet Union sweeping over Europe for all those years. And now he doesn't like NATO. He doesn't like NATO. He said, we don't see any reason why we should help NATO. And all of our allies have said that there's no reason why we should stick with these guys. When will it end? I don't know. It will end. But I can't predict exactly how. I do have faith, though, that the majority of the American people, some of them just now waking up, will be the majority that continues the country on its road to democracy and freedom.
Sam, in our final few minutes today, I want to talk about this. You're a lifelong member of the media, and in recent weeks, we have seen Scott Pelley fired at CBS 60 Minutes. We have seen the restructuring of CBS News. We have seen, I believe Leslie Stahl did say that she's been promised editorial control if she stayed at 60 Minutes to keep some continuity. I believe she's the longest standing correspondent there right now. It looks as if the merger is going to go through, and possibly the people running CBS might be making the editorial decisions at CNN, which is the worldwide news network everywhere. Colbert's out at CBS at this particular point. Kimmel's always under fire at ABC. Is the news business on television right now, in the internet, I guess what's where a lot of this is. Is it still the news business? Do we have freedom of the press right now, or is it under some serious fire?
Well, it depends on the organization. Scott Pelley, in my view, was basically correct, not the way in which he did it, because what you want to do is accomplish something. You want to make a deal sometimes. You want to move things forward. In cutting himself off, he must have known he would be fired. No management, no matter how wonderful or how corrupt, can possibly have that kind of tongue-lashing in public by a senior and respected news person and survive it. Now, if he wants to be Joan of Arc, she was burned at the stake, but she was right. So I'm not saying it was wrong. But there, at this moment, the news business, for so many, as you point out, has changed because of the economics. 60 Minutes is still a great program, but it was not the great program we remember, because it couldn't be. Pardon me, it had to make money. When that program was started in 1968, the news department didn't have to make money. The owners were very proud of it, the news departments they had. Today, it's all about the money. If you're owned by a corporate company, a huge multi-billion-dollar company, you want the money, and you want it any way you can get it, I hope legally, but you don't want to say, we have a tradition here. We have a tradition of doing stories that may be uncomfortable, that may make you think or what have you. No. I watched the ABC Evening News, a program I was associated with for many, many years and proud of for many, many years. I see the biggest collection of anything you can find that's visual, that looks good. Good evening, this is there's been a fire in the Bronx. Two people may have been injured. That's the lead story. I'm not imagining this. Later on, you may hear what President Trump wants to do now about Iran and the home of the states, but way down in the program. You want to see things that are visual, that entertain, that bring people in that would never want to watch the old ABC Evening News because there was nothing there for them. There was no hilarity. There was no fun from the standpoint of this. Oh, see the car that jumps over the edge of the embankment and everyone survives. Well, I think that's wonderful. but that's not the third news story in a broadcast. Mm. So I can criticize my own network. I'm not associated with it. And they may be right in the future if we have a free enterprise system in which, let's face it, money is the root of, if there may be some all evil, but it is the root of what we have in this country. And it's one of the reasons people can progress if they work hard.
Sam, before we wrap up here this morning, I do want to say this, because this is the 12th anniversary week here and over 9,000 hours of programming, that truly, I do believe that if I had been here and just talked for hours and hours, because some shows in radio are personality-driven now, and I think in the world of podcasts, a lot more are personality-driven. I always hope that this show is guest-driven, and you've got to have good guests to be guest-driven, and I have been lucky enough to have some of the greatest. You heard Madeleine Albright earlier, but Sam Donaldson is one of those people. And the fact that you come on, truly, people...
Don't forget Phil Albright.
You have that right. And
I don't mean Albright, no. Phil Donahue.
Donahue was very good to me for so many years. Sam Donaldson is a name that people know, a name that people trust, a voice that people recognize and they want to hear, and the fact that you have come on has lended this program a lot of credibility and a lot of very informative and entertaining moments, and you do come on short notice, and you do come on for 45 minutes, and you do give us a great analysis, which you have for the last 45 minutes, and I do get people all the time who say, I will get it this afternoon, I'll get emails that say, I always love when you have Sam Donaldson on. So you have my personal thanks, I think you know that, and may it continue on forever, I guess is the best way to put it.
Well, you're very brave in many senses. I know what your district is, I know what its voting is, I know people who must listen to the radio there, and quite often I disagree, I think, with their views. But you still have me on, and let me speak my piece. And that is the mark, in my mind, of the great interviewer, who doesn't play to the scene as I'm the expert. I just will tell you, I once knew a guy, I liked him very much in Washington, very smart. He'd have me come down to the studio. I'd put on some makeup, comb my hair, all of that. And finally I said to him one day, why don't I just stay home, knock down a Chardonnay, and listen to you? You are so bright, but I never have a chance to speak when I'm with you. You're different. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam, and we'll talk again soon.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. The legendary Sam Donaldson. All right, here comes the break. We've got more after this.
725-4380. Remember, that's Nate's Landscaping. Telephone number 725-4380.